Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The 29th of July, 1981, Prince Charles marries Lady Diana Spencer. An 8-year-old boy watches the fairy tale unfold. An hour later, he's missing.
Then, one day in 2020, a BBC reporter gets a call from a mysterious source.
Vishal, the extraordinary true story of a boy who went missing while the world looked the other way.
All lives are not treated the same.
Listen to Vishal.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 18th of April. The UN says more than 180 people have now been killed in the fighting in Sudan as the rival military groups ignore calls for a ceasefire. Two New York residents have been arrested on charges of operating a secret Chinese police station in Chinatown in Manhattan. And
a recent report found the number of girls aged between 10 and 14 giving birth increased by more than 300%.
The impact of COVID on girls in Uganda. Also in the podcast, the rice-loving rogue elephant whose case has gone all the way to the Indian Supreme Court, and a winery dating from the days of the Roman emperors. According to the UN, at least 185 people have been killed and 1,800 injured in 3 days of fighting in Sudan. The UN envoy, Volker Perthes, has condemned the violence and said he'd asked both sides, the regular armed forces and the RSF paramilitary group, who are loyal to rival generals, to hold a brief ceasefire to allow humanitarian access to civilians. Speaking after a meeting of the UN Security Council in New York, he condemned the killing of three World Food Programme employees and called for an end to attacks on UN and other aid organisations.
We strongly request both sides to respect the need to protect UN agencies, UN installations, embassies, aid workers, medical facilities. There have been grave transgressions here. The WFP, UNICEF, UNDP, UNHCR, guest houses and offices have come into the crossfire, all being looted and destroyed by men with arms in Darfur.
Well, Save the Children is suspending most of its operations in Sudan after looters stole medical supplies, laptops, cars and even a fridge from its offices in Darfur. Communications with people in the capital, Khartoum, are currently difficult. But Tim Franks managed to speak to Amjad Farid, a doctor and former assistant chief of staff to the civilian Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok.
For the third day in a row, we have been hearing the gunshots, the airstrikes, the excessive bombing. And obviously, we have people in the neighborhood who have been shot. RSF just stormed the houses looking for fuel and food and supply. Obviously, Khartoum is terrified. People are still locked down, large areas out of water. Obviously, it's not going to end soon.
People already are trying to go out for supplies, and especially these are the last days of Ramadan. It's more dangerous situation with medications. The problem is most of the shops and markets are closed, and it's very dangerous to move in the streets that's packed with fighters of RSF and the army. What happened for the past days, the leadership of the army and RSF showed utmost irresponsibility towards the country. They did not put the interest of the country or the citizens or the stability of this country in their heart.
What do you think can be done now to persuade General Burhan and the leader of the RSF, Hemeti, to lay down their weapons, given that the fighting is already quite bitter between the two men and the language is very strong between the two men?
The international community need to interfere to force the two generals to stop the fighting and for the RSF troops to go outside the residential area and outside of Khartoum. This needs to happen now, because the longer this continues, the more expensive the cost and the more difficult the intervention will be.
Amjad Farid in Khartoum. Both sides claim to have made gains during the day in the fighting. The BBC's Mercy Juma in Nairobi has been monitoring developments in Sudan.
We are just getting reports of residents having spent the whole day in Khartoum and in Darfur, holed up in their houses. People are not leaving. Civilians are afraid that if they step out, they don't know where exactly the army or the paramilitary people are and whether they are safe or not, because we've had reports of places that are deemed to have been safe being attacked by the men in uniform. It's nightfall now, and people are just, again, waiting to see how the night unfolds and how the morning breaks. To paint a picture of what people are saying, we're getting reports of being in a town that just smells of gunpowder, spending nights and days hearing just gunfire and the heavy machines and the heavy vehicles are roaming around the neighborhood. So a state of despair, and with the humanitarian agencies now folding, like you say, Save the Children has suspended most of its operation, WFP suspended some of its operations. So really looking at a bleak number of days if this goes on for the people of Sudan.
The UN envoy on Sudan, Volker Perthes, has said that current conditions and circumstances do not allow any aid deliveries to happen, but the UN will try to mediate some kind of ceasefire. What are the prospects of another humanitarian truce?
And, you know, it's not just about humanitarian aid. Even there were reports today that the IGAD was sending three African presidents to Sudan. That is Kenya's president, William Ruto, Salva Kiir from South Sudan, and Djibouti's president, and also the chairperson of the African Union Commission. They were supposed to go ahead, but again, the same reasons have been given, that the conditions are not okay. They are not welcoming for them to go, because as of now, the airport in Khartoum is inaccessible. There are no planes that are landing or taking off from there. And that aside, when troops started taking over key facilities like hospitals, we've had cases where you have said they have looted, but we've also had reports from other media houses of troops taking over hospitals, asking the medics to take away patients, and then they use that as their battleground.
Mercy Juma in Nairobi, monitoring events in Sudan. Last year, a new office opened in New York's Chinatown. China said it was intended to help Chinese nationals with paperwork issues. But the FBI says it was a secret Chinese police station used to intimidate critics of the Chinese Communist Party. Two New York residents were arrested in their homes on Monday morning, accused of conspiring to act as agents of China. If convicted, Liu Junwang and Chen Jinping face up to 25 years in prison. Michael Driscoll is from the FBI's New York field office.
This case is a further example of the audacious activities that the government of China has carried out right here on American soil. I want to be clear that the individuals arrested today were working at the direction of the Chinese government. Not only was the police station set up on the order of MPS officials, but members of the Chinese consulate in New York even paid a visit to it after it opened.
I had more about the case from our correspondent in New York, Neda Taufik.
The FBI says that when they learned these two defendants, that the FBI was investigating them, that they closed the office, that they got rid of messages they had on their phones with a Chinese government official. All of this, the FBI says, in order to obstruct their probe, which is why they are also charged with obstruction of justice. And the FBI says that they also spoke to several individuals who said that they were harassed, got anonymous phone calls, and were visited and told essentially that they needed to go back to China. So the FBI says even before they opened this secret police office, they were trying to locate persons of interest in the United States for China, including a pro-democracy advocate living in California.
Yeah, if all this stuff is true, China's reach seems extraordinary, going after critics as far away as New York.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, while this is seen as kind of the first time we're having a case of criminal charges related to one of these alleged outposts. It's believed that China has more than 100 of them around the world. I mean, there's been reported cases in the Netherlands, across Europe, Canada, Toronto, and obviously the ones we're talking about here in the United States. Now, China denies that. They say that these are service centers for their nationals, that during COVID, many of them got stuck and needed access to be able to get their driver's license renewed and have other support. But what you heard from the United States, I mean, you had a clip earlier, but we just saw a lot of outrage saying that this is a violation of America's territorial integrity, of America's judicial sovereignty. And I think many people can cast their memory back to the whole spy balloon saga. And it was very much the same kind of issue of the United States says this is espionage. China said that that was a weather research balloon that had blown off course. Here they say they're service centers. So I think what we're seeing is just these issues are continually popping up, and it's just increasing the tensions we're seeing between the U.S. and China.
And separate charges against 34 Chinese officials for allegedly harassing dissidents online, but I guess no further action since presumably they are all in China.
That's exactly right. I mean, a lot of the times these charges are seen as rather symbolic because nobody expects China is going to extradite anybody to face these charges here in the United States. I think what was quite unique about these two individuals was the fact that even though they had residence in China, even though they kept communications and traveled back and forth often, they were New York residents. And so that is how this prosecution is able to move forward. They were in court this afternoon and they were released on bond. No word yet, though, as to how they will plead their case and how this will develop. But it's certainly one that I think many across the globe will follow with intense interest.
Neda Taufik in New York. Despite largely disappearing from the headlines, COVID hasn't gone away. The WHO is currently monitoring a variant called Arcturus. The indirect impact of the pandemic is also still being felt. In Uganda, for example, it resulted in a significant increase in child sexual abuse and underage pregnancies. The situation is particularly acute in the north of Uganda, already suffering from a brutal insurgency led by the notorious warlord Joseph Kony. Paul Bachibinga has been investigating for BBC Africa Eye, and a warning, this report contains details that some listeners may find disturbing.
This is the antenatal ward of the regional hospital in Gulu, northern Uganda. A quarter of the babies delivered here have mothers under 18, the age of consent in Uganda. Dr. Baifa is the head of obstetrics and gynecology.
Because they are young, their body is not developed to handle a delivery, a pregnancy and all. And you'll find that young mothers are the highest proportion of those dying of obstructed labor.
In Uganda, unlawful sexual intercourse with a girl under 18 is known as defilement. The number of reported cases increased during the pandemic when schools were closed. And a recent report found the number of girls aged between 10 and 14 giving birth increased by more than 300%. This is one of the poorest parts of the country, and the community is still dealing with the aftermath of a brutal insurgency that went on for 20 years. The conflict ended in 2008, but experts say the effects have been long-lasting. Pamela Ngwech runs an organization working with the community post-war. She says sexual violence was used as a military strategy.
I describe it as the war was fought in the body of the woman and the woman became the battlefield.
One NGO that's trying to improve the situation is Caritas. We had a community event with a lawyer from Caritas, Eunice Lacarabe. She's sitting with a group of men, women and children talking about sexual abuse. Eunice grew up here and says it's difficult to change ingrained attitudes. We met many victims of sexual abuse, one as young as 3 years old. The suspect in that case was held for 6 months, but he was never prosecuted. The girl's mother told us she doesn't have the means to keep pursuing it. Here's Eunice again.
This particular case is not the only case of defilement being done on a very young girl, and she doesn't get the justice that she deserves. We have a number of them. I think it says a lot why most people don't have trust in the justice system. There is a lot of corruption.
People don't fear committing crimes here because they say if you have money, you get out. That is what is happening. That is what happens.
None of the suspects in any of the cases we investigated were prosecuted. The Minister of State for the Northern Region, Grace Freedom Chuyochwin, admits corruption is widespread.
It's at all levels, even at ministries level. We have laws on defilement. We have laws on incest. But somehow, again, people just go behind the law. There are cases which have been prosecuted, but the number is not high.
Police have acknowledged problems with how some cases are handled, but deny corruption is rife.
Paul Bachibinga reporting for BBC Africa Eye. The Supreme Court in India has refused to intervene in a case about the fate of a single elephant in the southern state of Kerala. The animal has killed at least seven people and destroyed crops and homes in its quest for food. I got more details from our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan.
It's very strange for outsiders to see how a single elephant issue has gone from High Court in the state of Kerala in southern India all the way to the Supreme Court. The issue is about safety of people. Now, this particular elephant, it's called Arikomban. For several months, it has been going around human settlements, bordering forest areas, damaging plantations. It eats sugarcane, banana plantations, even rice. In fact, this elephant got their name because it has a special liking for rice. Most of these houses will be like thatched roof or mud houses. So it will make a hole into the roof and take only rice. And it started even raiding the government shops which sell subsidized rice. So it was particularly going after those what you call ration shops, the government shops. So people have been protesting and they said this elephant should be captured. It is the duty of the local government. The issue went to the court because animal rights activists said you cannot capture this because once you capture this elephant, it will be tamed first. That's a months-long, very cruel process. And then they will be used for domestic purpose, which the animal rights activists didn't want. They said you can relocate it to another forest reserve. And that is what the High Court was recommending. Now, the government went to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court said, no, we cannot interfere at this point because this recommendation to translocate this elephant was based on expert committee report.
So what will happen to the elephant?
Now, the government should capture this elephant and it has to be taken to another forest reserve. But people living around those reserves are now opposing because once an elephant gets used to getting easy food from sugarcane plantations, it's not going to go back into the forest looking for food. So people are worried. And also, don't forget the communities living around forest areas, they depend on the forest. So these buffer zones are very risky. If you go out early in the morning, you can suddenly find an elephant. And this human-animal conflict, especially elephant and human conflict, it is increasing. You know, the elephants, they follow a certain route, what you call elephant corridors. Thousands of years they've been doing this. It is passed on from one elephant to another. Now, suddenly you have human settlements in between. So they get confused which way to go. That's one of the reasons why they end up coming near tea plantations, for example, in Assam, in northern India, and in the south as well, coffee plantations and tea plantations. And we're talking about between 400 and 500 people getting killed by elephants every year. And in retaliation, villagers also illegally kill elephants by putting country-made bombs or poison or electrocuting them. So about 100 elephants die in this manner. So that is why for environmentalists I've been calling for a sustainable approach so that the human-animal conflict can be reduced.
Anbarasan Etirajan, our South Asia regional editor. It is the most powerful rocket ever built, but a frozen valve has forced the postponement of the first launch of Elon Musk's Starship. The SpaceX craft is designed to take people to the moon and eventually to Mars. Our science editor Rebecca Morell was watching.
This was the first attempt at launching this massive new rocket into space. Standing nearly 400 feet tall, the Starship system was being filled up with fuel. But with just a few minutes left on the countdown clock, SpaceX announced a problem with a pressure valve.
We're just inside T-minus 9 minutes and counting. Flight director is talking about the issue we've had on first stage, working the pressurization system. Decision right now is that we are going to stop the launch for today.
It's not unexpected to experience delays on a test flight. This is a radically different system. Not only is it bigger and more powerful than any rocket ever built, it's also designed to be fully reusable. So each part of it is able to land back on Earth, ready for the next mission. Earlier in the day, Elon Musk said he was prepared for things not to go to plan.
I guess I'd like to just set expectations low. You know, if we get
far enough away from the launch pad before something goes wrong, then I think I would consider that to be a success. Just don't blow up the launch pad.
But the SpaceX team will try to fly Starship again. They say it will take at least 48 hours to get the rockets ready for another go. But they're determined to do this. Eventually, the plan is for Starship to return astronauts to the lunar surface in a joint mission with NASA. And the company has set its sights even further afield. They want to use the rocket to get people to Mars.
Rebecca Morrell. And still to come on the podcast...
The male partner goes to grab his female partner with his legs and misses, and she falls at a huge height to a ground. There's no safety mat, no safety net.
Tragedy in China as a trapeze artist plunges to her death. The UN, EU and others have condemned the 25-year prison term that Russia's imposed on opposition activist Vladimir Kara-Murza. A dual Russian-British national, he was convicted of treason and other offences in a trial he said was politically motivated. He has previously survived two attempts to poison him. The US State Department said he'd been punished for speaking out against Russian aggression in Ukraine. The UK Foreign Office called for his immediate release. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
For a political opponent of the president, this was a punishment unprecedented in its severity. In a Moscow courtroom, Vladimir Kara-Murza stood handcuffed in a bulletproof cage and listened as the judge declared him guilty on all charges, including treason. He was sent to prison for a quarter of a century. Mr. Kara-Murza is a former journalist, an historian, and a long-time critic of Vladimir Putin. A few years ago, he'd helped persuade Western governments to impose sanctions on Russian officials for corruption and human rights violations. That infuriated the Kremlin. He'd spoken out against Russia's war in Ukraine, on the international stage and at home. This is what he told me in Moscow just over a year ago.
This is not Russia's war. This is not a war by the Russian people and the Ukrainian people. This is yet another military adventure, military crime by an unelected, unaccountable, authoritarian and frankly increasingly deranged dictator in the Kremlin by the name of Vladimir Putin.
Vladimir Kara-Murza holds a British passport too. The UK joined the international condemnation of today's proceedings. Dame Deborah Bronnett is Britain's ambassador to Moscow.
The British government will continue to support him and stand in solidarity with him and his family, and we will continue to call for his release.
What will Britain do to try to secure his release?
We are continuing to ask for consular access to Mr. Kara-Murza, and we will continue to do that.
What's happened to Mr. Kara-Murza is a reminder of the danger in which politicians, activists, individuals who challenge the Kremlin are putting themselves. Most of the country's leading opposition figures have either fled Russia, are under arrest, or they're in prison.
Steve Rosenberg reporting from Moscow. People in China have been reacting with horror after online footage showed a trapeze artist falling to her death. The woman tumbled to the ground after losing contact with her acrobatic partner, who was also her husband. There's been speculation online about whether the two had had an argument beforehand, but the husband has denied that. I heard more from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
This happened on Saturday, and it was an acrobatic performance in central Anhui province. It's very unclear how this happened. At the moment, there's an investigation into the incident, but you see a couple who are both a romantic couple and an acrobatic couple doing a flying trapeze performance. And it looks like the male partner goes to grab his female partner with his legs and misses, and she falls at a huge height to a ground. There's no safety mat, no safety net whatsoever. And this video footage is all over social media showing this happen. It's actually horrific.
Yeah, they took her to hospital but couldn't save her.
No, they couldn't, no.
And she leaves behind two children as well.
She does, yes. It's a really sad story. It's not clear whether the partner who was part of this acrobatic performance, if he's the father of these children, but definitely a story that's caused a huge stir online. Lots of people saying that, yeah, although acrobatics do carry a high level of risk, this is people's lives at the end of the day. And there are concerns about whether they were performing without safety belts because it's a very competitive industry and they recognise that doing dangerous stunts could be a way of making more money.
What are regulations like in China for these kind of performances? Because often when you have acrobats, you do have a safety net.
You do, yes. And it's definitely evident today that the local government has said that the performance troupe involved in this didn't gain sufficient approval to carry out the performance. So they're saying the troupe are going to be dealt with accordingly. They're saying that certain measures should have been in place. At the same time, though, you see on Sina Weibo, a social media platform that's very popular, like Facebook or Twitter, social media users saying that they've seen so many performances like this and they feel that there aren't these regulations in place. And in fact, I've seen some archive footage of these two acrobats where they've been performing with rope hanging down from a crane. And literally, they're just reliant on each other's body strength for survival. There's absolutely nothing below them. They're very high up in the air. But obviously, stunts like this, acrobats have gone back hundreds of years, and being able to show that level of danger is something that is very exciting.
Are these kind of performances popular in China?
They are very popular. Yeah, you see them in many different places. You see circuses and performances on the street, for example. I mean, one of the things I remember when I was living in China, it was very common to see ex-acrobats in parks. You see people in their 70s performing stunts on rails and stuff that I literally wouldn't believe would be possible at that age. Very much an important part of local culture and tourism.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. One of the most closely watched media trials in decades is due to begin a day late in the US, unless it's settled out of court first. The $1.6 billion defamation case is being brought by voting equipment maker Dominion against Fox News and its parent company. On Monday, without explaining a delay, the judge overseeing the trial told both parties he expected them back in court on Tuesday to finish jury selection and for opening statements. The trial is seen as a test of press freedom and the reputation of the media giant. The BBC's North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury reports from Wilmington, Delaware.
The high-stakes defamation trial against Fox News was slated to start today, but was abruptly pushed back on Sunday evening. In court on Monday, Delaware Judge Eric Davis said that this wasn't unusual and that things happen. The delay has fueled speculation of a potential out-of-court settlement, with one of the newspapers owned by Rupert Murdoch, The Wall Street Journal, reporting on Sunday night that Fox was pushing for a deal to avoid a trial. During the four-minute hearing, there was no mention of settlement talks, and lawyers for both parties did not comment. At its heart, this case is about whether Fox News defamed Dominion by spreading false claims that the voting technology company rigged the 2020 US election against then-President Donald Trump. If proceedings move forward, media tycoon Rupert Murdoch may be compelled to testify in person.
Michelle Fleury in Delaware. After winning the Brazilian presidential election in October, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said he wanted to make Brazil a force on the world stage again. He's just returned from a state visit to China. And now Brazil is hosting the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. Mariana Schreiber Ribeiro from BBC Brazil reports from Brasilia.
The Brazilian government recommitted to form a group of countries to negotiate a peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine. The announcement was made during the visit of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to Brazil. For Russia, the conversation with the Brazilian government is important to show that the country is not isolated, despite the sanctions imposed by Western countries. On the other hand, Brazil's effort to negotiate a peace agreement is part of the Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's intentions to recover the country's relevance on the international stage. Last week, he met China's President Xi Jinping in Beijing, and he was also received at the White House by Joe Biden in February. Lula's strategy is seen as pragmatic by some analysts in Brazil as a way to balance good relations with the great powers. But his proximity to Russia and China and recent statements that the United States is encouraging war by sending weapons to Ukraine could strain relations with the White House.
Mariana Schreiber Ribeiro of BBC Brazil. And in the past couple of hours, the US has said that Brazil is, quote, parroting Russian and Chinese propaganda on Ukraine. Archaeologists have discovered a lavish winery in the grounds of a sumptuous pleasure palace dating from the Roman era. The sprawling complex near Rome from the time of the emperors is known as the Villa of the Quintilii. The lead author of the research, published in the journal Antiquity, is Dr. Emlyn Dodd, Assistant Director at the British School at Rome and a lecturer at London University. He described what they'd uncovered to Tim Franks.
The picture is one of a sensory overload. We can imagine the highest echelons of Roman society reclining while they watched people make wine, treading on grapes, pressing the grapes to make wine, surrounded by this kind of fountain system. It's really something completely unique in the Roman world.
And when you say a fountain system, are you talking about fountains of wine?
We are. We have three fountains of wine coming down from the production areas into the cellar where they stored and fermented the wine. And we also have two fountains of water. So a really interesting mixing of potential water and wine going on.
And in terms of the winery itself, I mean, I was reading details of it. I mean, it sounds incredibly lavish because I think it was comprised of red marble, even in the sort of the stamping grounds where the grapes were crushed, but which might be splendid, but not entirely practical.
It's completely true. We usually have these kind of facilities made of plaster or kind of waterproof concrete, which is much more grippy. And the fact that they were making these surfaces out of marble really shows to us that they're prioritizing this kind of extravagant luxury and theatre over this practical nature that we often find in these facilities.
Right, because presumably the floor would have got rather slippery. And in terms of the purpose of all this, does this mean that it wasn't just about making fine wine for the very elite of Roman society, but it was about the spectacle of watching that wine being made?
That's exactly right. We've got a similar facility used about 100 years earlier that we know the Emperor Marcus Aurelius sat at and watched. We've got one of his letters describing him doing that. So we think what we've got now in this new winery we've just discovered, also owned by an emperor about 100 years later, we think we've got something very similar going on here, where the emperor could sit here, he could watch the wine being made, this kind of ritual experience, and it was this kind of theatre for the super elite of ancient Rome.
You've made a fantastic discovery, but you know whether we can get anywhere close to discovering what this wine was like? I mean, whether there are any sort of vestiges of the grape varietals, of the techniques that we used?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, the sad answer in this instance is no. We didn't find any of the kind of archaeobotanical remains, these bits of grape skins or seeds, or any of the residues of the wine that we might have hoped to. Lots of really interesting works happening around the ancient world looking at this sort of stuff now. But we do know there was a treading area, there were two wine presses, so we know that they were treading grapes and pressing them, so perhaps making different qualities. What those tasted like exactly is really difficult to know in this instance.
Dr. Emlyn Dodd talking to Tim Franks. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.